Hi there, and welcome back to Holistic Health Masterclass Podcast with me, your host, Brett Hawes. I trust that you've been keeping well and that you have enjoyed the variety of episodes that I've been releasing lately. I've certainly been enjoying interviewing different types of people on different subjects within the holistic health sort of space. And today's episode is no exception. We're definitely going to be changing tack quite a bit. And today's title is entitled Taming Toxic People. If you recall, last week we discussed toxins in the home with Dr. Rob Brown. And this week we're talking about toxic people. And I'm speaking with David Gillespie. David is a fascinating individual who has a long history in all sorts of different industries and different jobs. And I always love speaking to people who are not just mono-trained, if that makes any sense. So David started out as a lawyer. He is a family man. And he had his own personal health challenges. He just noticed that, you know, adding on pound after pound after pound and just getting heavier and heavier, that all of his approaches didn't really work. And this prompted him to cut out sugar. And he subsequently wrote a book on sugar called Sweet Poison. That then really planted him firmly in the world of nutrition, and the books that he's written since then. He also has a book on toxic vegetable oils and cancer. These books got a lot of attention in Australia and worldwide from the dietetics associations, medical establishments, and so on and so on and so on. But, you know, he's very well researched. And of course, because he's had his own personal experience, that also carries a lot of weight for me. But this is now sort of leads us into what we're talking about today. And even for him, it seems a shift of tack, talking about toxic people and working with toxic people and being in relationships with toxic people and really how to deal with it. So David, as I said, started out as a lawyer, and you can imagine he dealt with some pretty nasty people over the years who really took advantage of him. And what he noticed was that they exhibited very similar behavior to one another. And the book that we talk about today and the pieces of that book really were a lifetime in the making and about 10 years to write. Our discussion today, we do talk a little bit about David's journey through food and health. We, of course, also talk about taming toxic people and everything to do with that. And then we definitely veer a little bit off track, but in the best possible way at the end, where we are starting to look a little bit at the sort of social constructs and the environment that we find ourselves in these days and how this might be influencing sort of psychopathic, sociopathic toxic behavior, if you will. It's a very, very interesting discussion that sort of meanders through a variety of different topics. But nonetheless, I think that you will find it very interesting and hopefully very beneficial as well. As always, if you do enjoy the episode, please consider sharing, commenting, subscribing, reviewing, whatever you can do to help us keep this show alive and bringing you more awesome guests. Anyway, let's hop in today's show, and hopefully you enjoy it. So, welcome to the show, David. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Brett.
So, David, you have quite the interesting background. You know, you're a family man, six children, but you have a history. I don't know if you started out as a lawyer, but just looking at your bio, I mean, you know, from IT startups to law. And then, you know, moving from that into writing books that have gained quite a lot of attention, you know, Toxic Oils, Sweet Poison, all about sugar, and then dipping your toe in the education system as well, and finally making your way into really what we'll focus on a little bit later on today, which is your latest book called Taming Toxic People. So perhaps you can give us just a little bit of a background as to sort of the trajectory and how did you find yourself where you are today?
Okay. So yes, I did start out in law. I trained as a lawyer and worked in some of the largest law firms in the world, actually, for quite a while. Ultimately, though, got sick of telling other people how to make money and decided to try and do it myself. Went in and did a tech startup that invented some document management software that ultimately got bought by Intel and Microsoft. So yeah, it was a strange trajectory, but none of that prepared me for what I was about to do, which was just start writing books. The book I started with is a book called Sweet Poison, and this is in fact 10 years this year since it was released. And Sweet Poison was a story about how I lost 40 kilos, but it wasn't a weight loss book. It was a book about the science behind what I discovered. So just a bit of background to that. I had spent most of my life getting fatter, like most of us. Every year a kilogram or two would come on, and every year I would just be determined, usually around about January, that I would do something about it, and I would try every kind of diet that I heard about. I tried them all, Atkins, low fat, walking the dog around the block, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they all worked. They all worked exactly as long as my willpower held out. So as long as I was determined to stick to whatever the diet was, I would lose a kilo or two. Now, that the duration of that was usually about 2 weeks. I don't have a lot of willpower.
Okay.
2 weeks would expire. I would be sick of it. I would stop doing whatever diet it was, and the weight would come back on, usually with a little bit of interest for good measure. What I didn't understand about it all, having, I guess, a bit of an inquiring mind, was why it would be the willpower was a necessary requirement for normal weight control. Why would it be that we had to have a manual override to control our weight, but not to control our height or our skin color or the rate we breathed at? I didn't get that. So I went looking for what we knew about the control of weight. And what I discovered really shocked me. I discovered that we'd known since the 1950s that a particular substance in our diet messed with our appetite control system and ratcheted it up a little and made sure that we ate more of everything all the time. And that same substance could indeed be traced through to many of the chronic diseases that now plague society: type 2 diabetes, kidney disease, heart disease, you name it. There was a cascade. That substance was fructose. I thought, oh, okay, so maybe it's the fruit making me fat, because that's where fructose is, isn't it? And then I discovered that, in fact, fruit was not the primary delivery mechanism for fructose in the modern diet. It was, in fact, sugar. In Australia, cane sugar. In the US, high fructose corn sugar and cane sugar. And in Europe, beet sugar. All the same stuff, all half glucose, half fructose. The science clearly demonstrated in the 1950s that there wasn't a problem with the glucose half of it, but that the fructose half of it we metabolized particularly poorly, in that because we had evolved in an environment where fructose was not plentiful, it was only available in ripe fruit when in season, it wasn't embedded in every aspect of our food supply, we were poorly adapted to it. And the way we were poorly adapted to it was that it turned to fat in our livers, creating fatty liver disease, which cascaded through to insulin resistance, which cascaded through to type 2 diabetes, which cascaded through to weight gain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I thought, well, you know what? The cure to this is to just stop eating fructose, which was a lot easier to say than do, but I did it, and lost 40 kilos effortlessly.
How long did that take?
So it took about a kilo a week. So it took about 40 weeks. So, the better part of a year.
Yeah, but that's healthy weight loss as well. I mean, if you're losing it at that rate, you know that you're going to sustain the weight loss and not just...
But the key part, from my perspective, was it didn't require willpower. Once I eliminated the thing that was messing with my appetite control system, which also happened to be addictive, it didn't require willpower. It was easy to do. And in fact, I have done that ever since. I lost 40 kilos, hit the weight I'm at now, which is, I'm not supermodel status, but normal weight. And that was 15 years ago.
Wow.
Now, that was incredible to me, is that I spent most of my life to that point getting fatter. And I'm sure that had I not done this, I'd probably be dead by now. But taking that out just meant I could eat whenever I felt like eating. I would stop eating when I was full. And food was no longer an addiction. And it just meant weight control happened automatically. Now, I wrote a book about that mostly because I got sick of explaining it to people. You just heard me explain it to you. It took forever. And I'd rather just say, well, just go read 2 courses. And a friend of mine said, look, this is new news. People need to know this. And I didn't think it was particularly earth-shattering or particularly controversial. The book essentially says don't eat sugar and then explains why. But it was met with such extraordinary resistance. 10 years ago when it came out, the media attacked me, the Heart Foundation attacked me, the Dietitians Association attacked me. I was in newspapers, on television, everything, being roundly attacked. And all I was saying was don't eat sugar, it'll be better for you. That was the extraordinary bit to me.
I've actually seen some of the stuff online before we met today, and it's pretty mind-blowing. I mean, you know, I had the same very similar discussion with Professor Tim Noakes, obviously, and, same story where you're just making a simple recommendation and just get slammed by the establishment for a whole bunch of reasons, and it's just kind of crazy.
There's two reasons they're attacking me. It's become clear to me now. One is just plain out corporate sponsorship, which is the Dietitians Association are sponsored by breakfast cereal companies and you know, the likes of Nestle and so on. So it's in their interests to attack someone who tells people to eat less of their product. I mean, that's fair enough.
Yeah. Yep.
It'd be a bit fairer if they disclosed that when running around saying that they were dietitians. But we're getting there. The Heart Foundation, similar thing. They had a tick program running. It was earning them, you know, $3 million a year. The tick program ignored sugar, completely ignored it, which meant that products that were 75% sugar and suggested as being sold for appropriate for children for snacks were getting a Heart Foundation tick, which is just nonsense. And so you could see the underlying motivation there might be financial. Yeah, who knows what their real motivation is.
And we have the same thing here as well. I mean, it's the same thing in North America, perhaps even worse than it is where you are.
With Canada, the interesting thing was a couple of years ago, the Canadian Heart Foundation or Heart Association actually pulled that. They were happily handing out ticks to slush puppies, as long as they were flavoured with fruit juice, as if the sugar that's in, it's been extracted from a piece of fruit is better than the sugar that's been extracted from a piece of sugar. And they're happily handing out certifications to them, but they changed their policy 2 or 3 years ago, and their turnaround on sugar has been really quite dramatic. I wish I could say the same about the Australian Heart Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole on that side of things, just because I know, there are definitely a lot of suspect foods and dietary recommendations that are still being pushed forward by doctors, heart and stroke foundations, diabetes foundations, and so on and so on and so on. So I think, we still have some ways to go, especially because these rates of disease are actually increasing. They're not going down, so we're clearly not really winning the battle there.
What has changed in 10 years is that sugar taxes are now firmly on the agenda. Now, I'm not a believer that a sugar tax on its own can change much, but I am a believer that these spokespeople for our health, like heart foundations and dietitians, are very attracted to money, and sugar taxes raise a lot of money. If that money goes to them contingent on them buying into the correct message, then I believe a lot can change.
Hmm. Yeah, and I actually saw you recently posted about that.
Yes.
I think it might have been on your blog or somewhere.
Yeah.
That's actually happening. I mean, I know that they're doing that in certain parts of the US as well. I think it's a little too early to tell really what's happening in terms of the general landscape. But who knows? I have mixed feelings about that personally.
So do I. Nothing I despise more than handing money to the people who got us into this problem in the first place. But it might be the only way to fix it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look like we're going to be penalizing the corporations or, getting them out of the mix, right? So, unfortunately, because that would really be the easy, well, not the easiest, but that would be the best solution is, you know, we've gone through some label changes here in Canada recently, and they haven't quite kicked in yet, but they're coming. Where you now have
to have the do you have the per 100 gram column on your labels or not? Or are you like the US and don't have them?
No, we do. Again, that's all changing now. Yeah. You have to reflect per serving. The per serving is changing. Because right. What they were doing is like, you know, for corn chips, for example, right? It's like per 13 corn chips, you know, here's the nutrition right. breakdown. And it's sort of like, well, who eats?
Per serving corn always chips, right? has been an irrelevant piece of yeah. information.
Yeah, exactly.
The only information in the US, and which means that you get ridiculous things like a Tic Tac saying it has zero sugar because that's the per serving amount. And because the amount of sugar in one Tic Tac is less than half a gram, they don't have to disclose it. So that's right. ridiculous in a product. But if it had a per 100 gram column, it would tell you it's 97% sugar.
Yeah. Well, that is one thing that they are, that most people are excited about is that they are changing. You have to now add the amount of added sugar on the label.
Yeah. I think that's just making loopholes. I mean, there's a campaign for that here in Australia as well. I think it's rubbish. Disclose the whole amount of sugar. It's usually half fructose anyway. The only exception to that is going to be dairy products. And then if you want in a dairy product to have a different labeling system because dairy products are going to have 5 grams per 100 in lactose. But everything else is going to be half fructose anyway. So giving them the added sugar loophole is just going to encourage companies to reformulate and get really cute about the definitions of added sugar.
Well, I mean, as history shows us, you know, it always repeats itself. So I do believe you. we'll have to see. Time will tell, you know.
Well, one thing coming from a legal background is that I'm immediately, whenever I see something like that, my radar for how would I work around this immediately goes up, and I can see hundreds of ways to work around an added sugar label, and I think it's just pointless.
Huh. Yeah, so that's interesting, especially for those folks listening out there, because I know that a lot of people are being excited about that. And I've always said,
it's
I mean,
per 100 gram labeling and clearly label the sugar content of a product on the front of the pack, or even if you don't want to do that, because food manufacturers say, that's way too expensive, you're way too onerous, et cetera, et cetera. Well, don't make the supermarkets do it. Make the supermarkets label in every product category the one that has the lowest sugar. So say, here's 15 different brands of cornflakes. This brand has the lowest quantity of sugar in it. Make that a government-mandated requirement, shelf label in every supermarket, lowest sugar product identified, and let the market race to the bottom. They will. If people care about mm-hmm. the sugar content, they will go to the products that are clearly labeled as being the lowest sugar choice, and they will buy them. And then the guy next to them that's got a little bit more sugar and is missing out on all the sales, what do you think he'll do next month? He'll reformulate.
He's going to have to. You force the hand, yeah. right? So
yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Good strategies there. So, I think it's amazing, first of all, that, you know, I mean, 40 kilograms, for those listening who don't know kilograms, you're looking at about 90 pounds or so, which is that's a good, significant amount of weight to lose. And for doing something so simple, I think it's very empowering for people out there. And I can hear when you speak and when you write, and you know, I've read a lot of your work, that you are very passionate about the subject because you've had a personal experience with it. And it's amazing to me. It's always amazing coming from people who have actually experienced it, because people who haven't, you sort of sit back and go, well, yeah, no, I get it, but I haven't actually experienced it. So sounds all right, you know?
Yeah.
So you know, then moving forward, you've now written on vegetable oil. You've got some pretty popular blog posts out there about vegetable oil and cancer.
Yes.
You know, how did you, you know, because I get all of the food stuff, right? So you had your own health transformation, which, you know, a lot of us in the health and wellness space have had. You know, we were sick, we fixed ourselves, and now we're going to go and tell others how to do the same.
Yeah.
But how did you work your way into writing a book about taming toxic people? How did that happen? That's a radical departure from what we're talking about here. You know?
Yeah, well, I had the misfortune working for one. I had the misfortune of working for one. Probably not just one. I've worked for quite a few, as it turns out. And I always found these people mystifying and confusing. So what I'm talking about is let's just get terminology straight here. We have lots of names for these people. We call them workplace bullies. We call them narcissists or malignant narcissists, sociopaths, psychopaths, etc. All those terms have at one point or another in history applied to one type of person. And the core and defining feature is a person completely lacking empathy, a person who ignores the golden rule. So the golden rule in all societies, all religions, all philosophies of humankind is do unto others as you would have done to you. In other words, don't treat other people worse than you would expect to be treated. It's a golden rule of human cooperation. Without it, humans cannot live in groups more than about the size of their extended family. Because if they don't respect others, they cannot cooperate. If they cannot cooperate, they cannot succeed. If you boil it right down, humans are pretty dreadful predators. We have no teeth, we have no scales, we have no poison, we have nothing. Nothing. We should be at the bottom of the food chain. We're a tasty bit of meat,
yeah,
as far as most predators would be concerned, with no ability to defend ourselves. The one thing we have going for us, and the one thing that has taken us to the point of owning this planet, is that we cooperate. No other animal does it. We do it because of the golden rule. The golden rule is hardwired into our brains, and that personality type, what I sort of describe as toxic people or just more generally psychopaths, are people who are not aware of the golden rule and in fact actively subvert it. In other words, they don't care at all about anybody else.
So it's really a self-serving agenda, and we will do whatever it takes to ensure that our agenda is sort of achieved. I mean, is that
absolutely.
Yeah,
but it's not a conscious decision. They're not deciding to be the enemy of everybody else. They simply don't comprehend what it is that everybody else has. They don't have empathy. They don't have the ability to feel what others feel. And they see that as a strength, and they see our ability to feel what others feel as a weakness.
I mean, is this sort of like, you know, the old adage of, you know, boys don't cry or don't show your emotions? You know, we see that a lot in the political and business world as well, where you know really got to keep a stiff upper lip and
that's play acting. This is much deeper than that. This is a hardwired difference in the way their brain is structured. Humans, that is most of us, what I generally refer to as empaths, which is probably 75% or more of humans, are empaths, which means that they have evolved a capability for empathy. Now, empathy means feeling what you feel. If I communicate with a person, I can feel what they are feeling. I do not have to experience what they are experiencing to feel it. And almost all humans can do that. Psychopaths can't and don't. And it allows them to commit atrocities in the sense that it allows them to hurt others without any compunction, without any regret whatsoever. And so they see no problem with pursuing their own agenda because all it means is hurting some other people. Why does that matter?
Yeah. So do you feel that this is something that they're born with, or is this like learned behavior? Where does this really stem from?
Well, the science on this is, the one thing we know is that the particular circuit that we're talking about, which is something called a spindle neuron in the brain, which humans evolved from the neurons which we use to differentiate between different smells, different tastes, different sounds, different colors. So we have a differentiation neuron in our brain. All mammals do have it. It's why a dog can smell better than us. They've evolved stronger capabilities in those neurons with regards to smell differentiation, etc. So we have that. We co-opted that neuron to develop empathy, which is a fine-tuning ability to almost read people's minds, at least as far as feelings are concerned. We are so good at differentiation, particularly when we listen to someone or look at their face, it's almost a psychic ability to differentiate right down to such a fine detail that we can actually feel what they're feeling. Now, that's what we've co-opted, the spindle neuron. No human is born with an adult set of spindle neurons. So babies are all born essentially psychopaths, in that they don't have that capability. Between zero birth and the age of four, humans develop to an adult set, an adult spindle neuron capability, from just about zero. Psychopaths don't. Now, the question is it because they never were going to, that is from birth, or is it that something happens to them between zero and four that impairs that development, or is it a combination of both? The answer is we don't know. The science is not clear on that at the moment. What we can say definitively is that by the age of four, you could shove a person's head in an MRI and you could probably pretty definitively make the call as to whether they're a psychopath or not.
So there is actually, and I'm just going to say this very bluntly, perhaps it's not, you know, correct scientifically, but so we actually do have in a way some sort of physical diagnostic criteria then?
Yes. Yeah? Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's well established now that MRI scans can tell the difference between a psychopathic brain and a normal brain.
Okay, so now obviously, I mean, we're not all walking around with MRI scans in our back pockets or at the house. You know, we can't check people on the way in. So
no, and very few psychopaths would be likely to agree to shove their head in an MRI so that you could tell.
So, I mean, okay, so you've also experienced this firsthand. Like, you know, what? Give us a sense of what, you know, first of all, like, how do you know who these people are? Like, what are the signs to look for? How does the sort of relationship really build? Because, I mean, you know, if you look at like obvious people, I'm not going to name any names right now, but let's just say everyone, you know, called a serial killer a psychopath. Everyone go, okay, great, that he's a psychopath. We get it. But what
you know, I'm not talking, I mean, there's no doubt.
This is exactly what I'm getting to, is we're not talking about those sorts of extremes. We're actually talking about people who are just walking around everyday life, but who are who still exhibit the same type of behavior, just not expressed to that extent. So how do we sort of navigate this and how to identify these people?
Okay, the only difference between a criminal psychopath and a non-criminal psychopath really is access to resources. A criminal psychopath has had to do what they had to do to get what they wanted to get using means which landed them in jail. If that psychopath had had access to better resources, more intelligence, more money, etc., they wouldn't have landed in jail. There isn't a difference physiologically in these people. They're still all psychopaths. It's just the tools that they have available to them in order to get what they want to get. But the ones that are ending up in prison, whilst, yes, that is an enormous drag on society, they are half of the people in the prison population. They cycle through prison in and out much more quickly than people who are not psychopaths because they're so convincing at talking people into believing they have rehabilitated. You know, a psychopath will be back and forth to prison three times in the time that a non-psychopath convicted of the same crime will be. Now, and that leads us to one of the first clues to identifying these people. Psychopaths have to pretend to be like us because they aren't like us. They don't feel empathy. They don't feel what we feel. If you were standing next to a psychopath watching a tragedy unfold on television, say a school shooting or something like that, it would be hitting you in the pit of your stomach as every bit of it would be, you'd be feeling the terror, every part, every emotion involved with that, you'd be feeling. Even though it's only occurring on television, the psychopath next to you would just be curious. What are the technical details of that? What is that truck there? What are those police doing? You know, they don't feel anything. To them, it's just an interesting piece of information. But if they behaved like that standing next to you, you'd think they were a weirdo. And so they have to try to pretend to feel. And that's what they spend most of their lives doing. It takes enormous effort, and a lot of the time they can't manage it in complex situations, and you get a bit of a feeling about them of something's off with this person, something's just not right. You know, it might be a lag in how they react to something, it might be that they react inappropriately to something. And I give an example in the book, where Donald Trump, for example, was watching, he was being interviewed on television about at the moment that the second plane hit the skyscraper at the World Trade Center, and they're watching it on the screen. They're watching the building explode, etc. And the interviewer asked Trump his reaction, and he said, you know, my building is actually the second tallest building in New York, or something like it was something to that effect.
Wow.
You know, which is may well be an interesting fact at any other time.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, at any other time. I mean, wow.
Yeah. But and that to me is a terrific example of the way they think. They can just completely miss that this is something where you are supposed to have feelings, you know, because they're focused on something else. Mm. And that's often a really important giveaway, a tell, if you like. But in general, if people are working with someone who they suspect to be like this, and they probably know already, but that, if they recall back to the first time they met them, if they're working with them or in a relationship with them, these people were the most charming person they've ever met in their entire life. The first time they clapped eyes on them, they would have come away thinking, you know what? This person is terrific. This person is a fantastic person. And the reason for that is that the psychopath is an absolute charm machine. The psychopath can read you like a book. They can tell exactly what you want to hear, and they can reflect it back to you perfectly. and they're not doing that because they are psychic. They're doing it because they listen carefully to what you say. And if they're a little bit more sophisticated, they read carefully what you say and do online before they meet you. The reason they're doing that is that they've had to develop that almost psychic ability to read and listen, because they don't have the ability the rest of us have to pick it up on autopilot. So, like a blind person who can hear a lot better than everybody else, because they've had to focus their energies on hearing things.
Right.
A psychopath is the same. They have to focus their energies on manually reading people, because they don't have that sense of empathy. So they're missing a sense, and they focus on that one. So they're very good at reading us, which means that they're really, really good at reflecting back to us what we want to hear, which makes us think they're fabulous. You come away from a meeting with them thinking, wow, that guy's on my wavelength. He's saying exactly what I think. And, you know, he must be a terrific person.
But driving it underneath it all, there is this like narcissistic personal agenda in the background the whole time. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, they wouldn't be bothered doing it if you didn't have some value to them. So someone else might come away from the same meeting and say, you know what, he's a complete idiot. I don't want to have anything to do with him. And that's because the psychopath didn't bother reflecting back to that person something. So the psychopath had decided that you were valuable to them, but the other person wasn't. And that's why you'll often get really divergent views about these people. If you talk to people in a workplace, some people will think this is the best thing since sliced bread, this guy, he's fantastic, and other people will hate them. And there's rarely an in-between view. There's people who love them and there's people who hate them, and there's no one who just doesn't have any opinion. And that's one of the really big telltale signs in a workplace, is that there's a group really big fans of this person and another group who really, really hate them.
And it's so funny when you say that, because I think that we can all relate to that. I mean, we've all known people like that throughout our lives. So, you know, I don't think that you're sort of highlighting just your personal experience and then that's the story. From reading your work, that you've also spoke to, I don't even know how many people over the years about this, and everyone's sort of going, mm-hmm, we're all nodding our heads going, yep.
this is a book. I mean, yes, it is my latest book, but, you know, the things that have informed this book, you know, I've worked in some of the largest law firms in the world. I've worked in tech startups. I've worked with venture capitalists. I've had my fair share of exposure to people like this. And so this is a book that's been, you know, 30 or 40 years in the research. It's just that I finally got to the point where I can condense it and actually put it in writing, which is why it's now coming.
So, I mean, are these types of people going to be like overtly malicious, or is it, you know, how do they operate from your experience? I mean, what is your experience like working with these people on a daily basis?
They will be overtly malicious once they have you captured, once you've given them the job, once you're in the relationship with them, once you're in a position of dependence on them in some way. Then they will be malicious. But even then, only to selected audiences. You know, it will happen behind closed doors, or it will happen in private meetings, or if you know, they'll try to maintain a facade for others. So in an organization, you might have a person, say they're the chief executive or something, who's like this. They might be fabulous if the board are around, because the board can influence that person's future directly. Mm. But if it's an underling, then they'll rip them to shreds. So it's an old management truism, kiss up and kick down, and that's the way they behave.
And you can tell
they're in a workplace pretty easily, because the workplace goes from a relatively harmonious place where people cooperate and get on and focus on the best result for the business or the organisation, to one where there's a lot of infighting. People don't know who to trust. They don't know whether someone's on the side of the psychopath or not on the side of them. There's a lot of emotional stress going on, and all of that infighting between people who previously might have had little niggles. The psychopath is terrific. One of their real talents is driving wedges into those little niggles. So finding out that there's a little niggle between person A and person B, shoving a giant wedge between them of mistrust. The psychopath loves everybody to mistrust each other. They love constant tension, constant conflict, because while that's all going on, they can get on with their agenda of doing what suits them.
Wow. And again, like when you speaking about that, it just resonates, because we've all experienced those kinds of people.
Well, you know, the whole of the United States is experiencing it right now.
Yeah, 100%.
The divisions have always been there. But you've got a president at the moment who's expert at turning those little divisions, those little fissures, into giant chasms. And while everybody's fighting each other, he's getting on with his own agenda.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, because there's definitely a lot to talk about, not pointed directly at Donald Trump, but I think I want to sort of break this out into a global cultural society kind of discussion in just a second, but. So coming back to this, obviously that looking at these types of folks in the workplace, how does this manifest itself in relationships, in like personal and familial relationships? What's it going to look like?
Well, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same pattern repeated over again. So a psychopath if they're your partner, mm-hmm. Will initially have been the most charming person you've ever met in your entire life. Once you're in a committed relationship with them and it's hard for you to just leave, then they will start to behave as their true self. They won't bother pretending anymore with you. It takes a lot of effort to pretend. And they'll frequently manipulate you to do whatever it is that suits them. If these will be remarkably petty things. You know, people think of psychopaths as having some giant agenda. They're not. They're just the next thing they want for themselves. And that might be as simple as getting you to put the washing machine on instead of them having to do it. The lengths they will go to just to achieve the smallest increment of extra for themselves really is amazing.
And I think that's something that I've seen a lot in my career as, really helping people in a one-on-one setting, is you hear that a lot about power struggles, these power struggles in relationships, and, people just feel like they're being taken advantage of the whole time, like they have to do more, they pull more of their weight, they feel like their partner is just a complete taker without really contributing anything. But I think that, it kind of makes you wonder about...
That's absolutely right. I mean, someone who's in that kind of relationship will not. I'm not telling them anything they don't know. They might not have a label for it, but they'll recognize the characteristics.
Well, I think that's exactly it, because you know, when you say the word psychopath, I mean, the immediate images that come to mind are, again, serial killers, crazy people, you know, big actions. And I think that the thing that I'm really getting from you and taking away from you is that the label itself is a label, but the behavior can be very, very dialed down, in a sense, where we don't have to see what we're seeing on the news. You know, it's happening
all the time. Absolutely. This is a day-to-day thing that's happening. And often the aims of the psychopath are really very petty. And the aims measured against the damage they do to attain those aims are mind-blowingly insignificant. And that's worth bearing in mind, is that they're not there to, you know, make massive change. They can't think strategically. They're impulse-driven. Yeah. And those impulses are really about their own pleasure. So whatever is good for them in the next day, is where they are focused.
And so the people that are involved in these relationships, obviously, I mean, it must just take a huge psychological toll, because you just feel like you're getting dragged down and worn down every single day. And
absolutely.
Perhaps you're being taken captive in a sense, right?
Absolutely. And particularly given the types of tools they use, they're often not overtly physical. Sometimes they are. I mean, if that's all they know, that's what they will be. They'll use threats of violence, etc. But they're also extremely talented manipulators. As I said, they've developed a sense of being able to read us. So they know how to manipulate us. They know what our buttons are, where they are, and how to push them. So they are really talented manipulators. And they will manipulate those around us to achieve an aim as well. So they have a suite of things that they like to do. So one of the first things they'll do is cut you off from any support network. So if you enter a relationship with a psychopath and you have close relationships with friends, family, etc., any of those that might influence you away from the psychopath's agenda will be immediately cut off. So you'll find yourself having nothing to do with these people. And it'll be from a mixture of manipulative techniques. One of the favourite ones of psychopaths is gaslighting, which is essentially telling you black is white and having you believe it. They'll tell you something one day, they'll tell you the opposite the next day, and they'll tell you that you're imagining that they said the opposite thing the day before. They'll be able to be quite convincing about it. And they'll be persistent with that, and to a point where you really won't know what is true. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to put you in a state of confusion where whatever they tell you at that particular moment is what you accept.
Huh. And again, you know, just knowing people like that, right? You know, it's kind of crazy. So let's just, you know, so we identify these people. And I know that people listening to this right now are starting to go, okay, wow, I definitely know some people like that, either in my work environment, my family, my whatever. What does one do? Like, how do you approach this and sort of like break yourself free from that?
The psychopath's kryptonite is absolute honesty. That if we behave honestly in everything that we do at all times, we can defeat psychopaths. I mean, there are very specific micro strategies that you can employ, which I go through in quite a bit of detail in that book. But so, for example, in the workplace, don't allow yourself to be manipulated. Don't allow emotional tools are how they manipulate us in the workplace. So they will attack us in the hope of getting a rise out of us so that they can see what we respond to so it can be used against us next time. They will induce us into dishonesty. They might wave through a credit claim, an expense claim that, it was a bit doubtful. And as soon as we agree to that, take part in that, they have a lever against us. Forever after, they will.
So what you're saying is they'll almost put you in these questionable situations, perhaps, and then if you kind of slip up, quote unquote, they've got you, and then they're going to leverage that from there on out.
That's exactly right. So they'll put you in a situation where they tell you a piece of information that they shouldn't, or they let you get away with something that they shouldn't, or you know, it'll be a grey area. It won't be completely black and white. It'll be something where you could justify it to yourself. And if you go for it, they know they've got you. And then they know that they can manipulate you from thereafter. But if you're already working for a psychopath and you just want to get out of there, you can't just up and leave, because they will be vengeful. They yeah. will attack you. They will take you down. What you have to do is be very prepare over a long time. Leave only when you are ready to leave, and in the meantime, protect yourself. And the way to protect yourself is take notes of every interaction. Do not react emotionally at all, and build yourself a network of support that is outside your workplace. So that because one of the big problems people have in dealing with psychopaths is that when you come home and say, "Bob got Mary to finish my assignment," they think you're mad for blowing up about that. You know, so mm-hmm. what? You know, who cares? But it's in the context of 1,000 manipulations that have occurred prior to that. You need someone who's dialed into exactly what is going on, that you can talk to regularly about it and keep sane.
Yeah. Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head there, because the types of relationships that we're talking about here, we're talking about personal relationships. We're talking about people who have maybe been in their career for 10, 20, 30 years. These decisions are not just, oh, okay, we'll just cut our ties and walk away. Yeah. It's very difficult to do that, because we're really talking about very, you know, life-altering, big, big changes.
But at the end of the day, if the company's not prepared, if a psychopath is in a important position in the company, CEO or in charge of a section or something, and the company's not prepared to do something about that, that company is toast anyway. I mean, they're dead mm-hmm. anyway. It's dead man walking, because psychopaths are not there for the company. The company is a collective organisation. It's there for the purpose of the collective, to progress the aims of the collective. Psychopaths do not understand that as a motivation, and they will destroy it if they can get something out of it for themselves. So if you are in a position like that, and someone like that is in charge, and the company will not recognise or do something about it, then you must leave anyway, no matter what level of personal interaction you have with the person, because yeah. that is a diagnostic that your company is about to die anyway.
Yeah, well, because that's the whole agenda anyway of the actual psychopath running the show.
Well, they're not intending to destroy the
company. No.
Yeah, if they do.
Yeah. So you touched on a couple things here that I want to sort of zoom in on. One is you mentioned people in power, and I think, like, I want to sort of break that open into another question, which would be, do you feel, or like in your research and what you've come up with, is it usually people in power that are like this, or do we find that it's people all across the board? I mean, are there any specific industries, or, you know, I mean, the reason why I'm saying all of this is we're obviously dealing with a leader and leaders in the world who are exhibiting this kind of behavior. We've got a movement that has now been started as well, you know, coming out of Hollywood, where we are, you know, looking at the Harvey Weinsteins and these types of folks, where there's a lot of this type of psychopathic behavior that's being displayed. And so I just kind of wondered to myself, you know, I mean, is this something that's happening higher up? Is this happening to regular folks? Perhaps you can speak to that a little bit.
Okay, so I guess the first thing that comes out of that is there more of it now than there ever has been before?
Exactly.
I suspect the answer is no. I think the biological level of psychopathy is probably about the same now as it was 100,000 years ago when empathy first emerged. Psychopaths are a throwback. They're human version 1.0, the one that can't cooperate or work in groups. Human 2.0, first hit the planet about 100,000 years ago. And I don't think the ratios have changed much biologically. There's no real evidence that that's true. What has changed is our ability to control them. Communal societies, people that cooperate for a group purpose, communal societies, which all human societies were as hunter-gatherers, they had to be by necessity, manage psychopaths well. because the community doesn't tolerate the aberrant behaviour that they display. Communities understand what they are and they have to play by the rules of the community, end of story.
Well, and I, on that note, I mean, back then as well, it was imperative to our survival that you cooperated as a community, where I think the big difference now is we're living in way more of an individualistic, narcissistic, self-centered society where...
And there's good data on this. Like, so as societies become more modern, if you like, there are actual metrics of individualism. And in terms of individualism, the most individualistic societies in the world today are the United States, Australia, the United Kingdom, Canada. So they are all highly individualistic societies. They all score in the 90s out of 100 for individualism.
And it's being encouraged. It's being actively encouraged as well, which is...
The question is, are things that encourage, I mean, often things like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are blamed for facilitating individualism. But I think the better way to think about it is that those are a symptom of individualism rather than the cause.
It's catering to it, yeah.
Yeah, I think we were trending well and truly towards individualism before those tools came along and helped. But the consequence of an individualistic society is that there is a much greater loosening of community control of psychopathic personalities. They get to shapeshift. They get to change jobs easily. They get to have no reputation. They get to reinvent themselves. They get to do what they like. And even within organisations, as organisations become less structured and more centred around the superpowers of individuals, psychopaths play well in those environments because they can pretend to be anything they want to be. Now, that doesn't mean they have the skills, and it means the organisation will ultimately suffer, but they can at least look like they do. So as society trends towards individualism, we have much less control over psychopathy. So it would feel like there's a lot more of them because we are not controlling them. We can control them if we want to. All we have to do is require honesty. Honesty in all dealings with our customers, with our employees, open, honest communication. I go through this in quite a bit of detail, exactly how you would implement it, which I won't bore your listeners with today. going to the second part of the question about are they more prevalent in some places rather than others? Well, yes. Psychopaths prefer power over others. There's not much point being a psychopath and being at the bottom of the tree. Those ones are the ones that end up in prison because all they've got left is, committing a crime to achieve what they wish to achieve. If they have any ability to have powers over others, then they will gravitate towards roles where that is the case. And so there have been lots of studies of this sort of thing. One of the most popular ones is one done out of the UK, an online study, so it's dubious in that sense. But I think it tells us something. It's got a massive sample, and it tells us that CEOs, lawyers, members of the media, members of the entertainment industry, politicians, these are all people who are more likely than not to have psychopaths in pretty large numbers. And the commonality between all of those things is that they do have power over others. An interesting dichotomy is in medicine, for example, where surgeons score high on the list of likely to have psychopaths, whereas general practitioners, the doctors in the community, don't. Similarly, nurses score low on the list of psychopathic professions, whereas, as I said, surgeons are where the patient is unconscious and you have to essentially be able to cause intentional harm to another human being scores pretty high. So I guess the net of it is anywhere in any organization, no matter what the profession, the closer you get to the top of that organization, the more likely it is that the people you are dealing with are psychopaths.
And I mean, I think, we're, because of the flow of information, because information is a lot more readily available, there's a lot more exposure these days. I think that's perhaps another reason why it might seem like there's a lot more coming to light. But perhaps as well, a lot of this type of behavior has just simply been buried from our conscious awareness, or we haven't actually put it into some kind of framework where we can really operate in. And I think that
it's an interesting
books like yours is doing exactly that, which is great.
It's an interesting dichotomy, is that individualism drives two quite different and opposite threats. Individualism drives the tendency towards losing control of psychopaths, but it also drives the towards individual rights. That is, that everybody's different and everybody has rights. And so at the same time, you've got society fragmenting into individualistic agendas, and everybody has rights. And that enables the psychopath to do what they're doing because there's lack of community control, but it also enables the people that they're manipulating and victimizing to feel empowered to do something about it. Now, the big question is what they are doing about it effective? I think the jury's out on that.
Yeah, I think it's. I agree with you 100%, because we're starting to see a lot of backlashes now. We're starting to see things that, you know, good intentions, people meaning well, and not really.
The science tells us. The science tells us that the thing that is most likely to be effective against psychopathy is communal action. If everybody in your workplace unites against the psychopath has no power. If everybody in your community unites against the psychopath, the leader has no power. So it's about communal action.
Do you feel like we're starting to see that more, though? I mean, as much as we talk about an individualistically driven society, especially in the West, do you think that, because I mean, I start to get a sense that there's this communal undercurrent, if you will, that is starting to boil up, you know?
Let's see. I mean, it's certainly looking promising in a number of areas. Let's see if it manages it or if it fragments into individualistic agendas.
We see, and this I think is you know, to take that one step further, my concern with that is that because the architecture that we find ourselves in, where, you know, we have an individualistic society, we have news and news feeds and social media that are targeted and based directly on our actions. So the more that I associate with like-minded people, the more that I tap into certain types of articles and narratives and whatever, mm-hmm. the more of those types of things I'm going to see. And then the more that you have this collective mentality, this tribalism breeding around that, mm-hmm. my concern with that is that we are finding ourselves lost in echo chambers. Because we're not actually seeing what the other discussions are, or if that makes any sense.
No, it makes it perfect sense, and that's exactly what's happening. The interesting thing is how that's being manipulated.
Exactly.
So you know, for all the hullabaloo about the Russians interfering in the American elections, I think that's been going on for quite some time, which is sophisticated attempts to manipulate those echo chambers. Tell people what they want to hear in key areas. So in not for everybody, but just in areas where a few votes are going to make a difference, where something has been gerrymandered or it's a very, very marginal seat. Those sorts of programmatic manipulation using algorithms of the echo chamber effect, which is what you've described, mm-hmm. is I think a powerful tool in those who want to influence the outcome of democratic processes. And the big question going forward, I guess this may be too big for a show.
That's all right.
One of the things I think about is, what does that look like in 10 years' time when the tools that are being used today are amateurish by comparison? We are getting to a point where AI can very effectively manipulate messaging. And when it's properly targeted, it can have a big effect on democracy. And that means that it's not so much that we're getting the people we want, but the people we've been told by algorithms we want.
Yeah, well, it does make you wonder then how someone like Donald Trump got into the mix there and actually became.
I think it's just he's just one of the more obvious examples. You know, I don't think it's limited to him at all.
Definitely not. I think it's interesting in the context of what we're talking about, you know, because it really highlights, I think anyway, it highlights something that's perhaps a little bit more pervasive in society and culture.
Yeah, absolutely. All he's doing is bringing it writ large so that it becomes very obvious. But that doesn't mean it's not happening at much less obvious levels.
Yeah. And so I wonder, I mean, just to sort of boil this right down, I really wonder what this means for us in terms of our individual conscious, in terms of our individual health, you know, our individual well-being in whatever way that is, because we are, you know, the conversations that are going on, the line of thinking, the way that we feel about certain things, the way we express ourselves are all being affected by these things that are way bigger than us. And so I do wonder what the road looks like, you know?
Simple rules, right? Which is get back to the concept that made us great in the first place. And by us, I mean humanity. Get back to the concept that got us there in the first place, the ability to cooperate. So always have an eye to the communal good in every action you pursue. Always be honest. If you are honest, psychopaths have nothing to use against you or anybody else. It is going to be hard to be honest at times, but you have to be. And that is your best individual defense against them.
Yeah, and I guess if we are doing that in a collective effort, that will...
If everybody does it,
yeah,
they're gone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you sound like a very honest guy. And myself, I call things how they are. I don't really know how to play games. So on that note, David, I'm going to start wrapping things up here. But, you know, it's been a very enlightening conversation. You know, I can tell that you've been looking at this and have experienced it personally for many years now to be able to speak like that. Just before I let you go, though, you know, what's coming down the pipeline next for you? Any sort of current projects or ventures that you can share with people?
I'm under contract at the moment to produce a book about teenagers, what's normal and what's not. So I have quite a lot of them now. I have six teenagers and, well, a few have gone beyond that. But it's about looking at some of the things we've been talking about today too, is there's been a real shift in the way the generation born since the turn of the century, have grown up. They have grown up in a very different environment to all the generations before them. And they are the first to grow up in a fully individualistic society where all the tools of individualism are at their disposal. And it's having a very, very big impact on them. These kids are the safest physically they've ever been. You know, bullying's half what it was when they were born. Physical bullying, that is. You know, they're unlikely to be, less likely to be in a car accident, less likely to be drunk, less likely to get pregnant as a teenager. These are very, very safe kids, mostly because they never leave their bedrooms.
They're stuck in the Xbox and Facebook, right?
And on Facebook. What does that mean for our society? What is normal behavior for these kids? And what should parents be doing about what they observe? So this book focuses on that. And so hopefully it will be enlightening. Manuscript's due in June. Probably come out later in the year.
Okay, awesome. Well, we'll definitely get you back on the show for that one, because it is a topic that keeps surfacing. I get a lot of people asking me about their kids' health and screen time and all of the stuff that we're talking about. So I think it'll be awesome to have you back on the show.
Absolutely.
And obviously, for those of you listening, I will be sharing David's links to websites and books and whatnot, so you can check out the show notes for that. David, it has been an awesome show. Thank you so much for coming on.
And great to talk, Brett.
Yeah, so those of you listening out there, if you enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it. Obviously, you can subscribe as well, and you can shoot us a message at support@holistichealthmasterclass.com or catch up with us on Facebook, ironically enough there, David. All right, David, you have yourself a great day and great chatting with you.
You too. Thanks, Brett.
Take care. Bye.